Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. Well, with our final seminar this evening, are you as smart as you thought you would be when you began, or at least 75% of the way there?
I think the more I learn, the more I realize how unsmart, not how smart.
Well, thank you, Deb. Questions or comments, things that would be helpful for us to talk about at this point?
Yes, I enjoyed all the division of 25 ways of this and the RX, how we can fix it and what we can do. I know we don't have time for that, but I would love if either any of the participants who use this already, I haven't, or you, would be able to just give a tiny example of this used with a client where it didn't work and what we can do when we want to troubleshoot. Because my concern was when things go well, it's wonderful, but when things stagnate or there's resistance, how could we troubleshoot? I really was missing a troubleshoot list.
Okay, the list is not something I would go over with a client. The list is for you, for training purposes, to
right,
really
right,
alert.
I mean for me.
Okay, so the list is to really listen for these possibilities, to cue your radar, to be aware when you hear of something that will give you some awareness to have a nomenclature, to have a system, a way of listening, and to understand and be able to attach some meaning to what you're hearing so that you'll be able to get curious about it together with your client. So in the sense of one of the simplest ways that we think of mentor coaching is we listen with a client together until we hear something that doesn't make sense, and then we get curious together. So this is simply a way of coding your radar for some of the possibilities of what you might hear so that you can discern a meaning and really come to know what you're hearing so that you can explore it with a client. Does that make sense in terms of the intent here?
Okay, yes. It's like regular coaching, but we're focusing on this.
None of these things
right.
are ones that I would, you know, go over with a client necessarily, but these are simply ways to get your awareness. Now, some of the tools you may want to use with a client, but everything we're talking about is for your awareness and your understanding for ways of informing your listening and applying the mind and brain sciences to strategic coaching to create changes that last with your client. So that's really the purpose of this.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. I think that's helpful. I'm glad you said that. Other thoughts or questions or comments or challenges with clients in this regard? Would anybody want to offer what's been the one thing that you've recognized that has been unexpected or surprising to you out of what we've talked about? Or the one thing that has seemed to be most important thus far about what we've talked about? Anyone?
Okay, I'll go again. I don't mean to hawk tonight, but to me, money being something that is really, I know they say love makes the world go round, but really money does, and how most of us, I'm taking responsibility for myself, hardly give it a thought unless there's too little of it or there's a problem with it, instead of being trained and connected to the various levels all through our lives. I think it is totally ignored in elementary school, in high school, even in colleges, and I am shocked and surprised at that oversight.
I agree with you. And when we consider how much of the shadow story, how much of our operating system is informed by the money stories, the meanings, the attachments, the kinds of regard that we have of money, the attachment and behavior patterns we have to it, of that has been downloaded from other people important to us, who have their own money stories, what it's meant to them, how they regard people who have less or more, what it says and what they say with it. Basically, it being such a universal Rorschach, it's just helpful to know that it is a Rorschach and that people are unaware, and that can help us listen, I believe, in a better way and in a more informed way, because people can have money issues that they don't even recognize are money issues, or that so many things hitchhike on money issues. You know, far and away, the number one cause reportedly of divorce is money, but so much of the issues that hitchhike on money are really the cause, and very few have to do actually with money itself. So I think it's just helpful to know and to be listening from that perspective of what we can understand about how someone constructs a story and how we can help someone revise or construct a new one.
Right. That's true. I would say that money is a form of communication, and since the whole world between ourselves and others and everything it entails, the whole world is into the information and communication age, it's unbelievable how it's cast aside and not thought of. That's all. And it was a tremendous eye-opener for me.
Well, great. Thank you. You know, we sometimes have to put a lot of work into getting to the simplicity of something, and only then can we recognize and appreciate how much complexity has been attached. And I think money is one of those. There are a lot of emotions and issues that are that way, that they're essentially very simple, but it takes a lot of work to get to the position of simplicity to be able to understand all the complexity. So this is an example and a model for that. Other thoughts or questions or things you'd like to talk about? Well, I'm going to get into the material then, and I want to save some time at the end. So if there's anything you want to talk about, jot it down, and I'll be sure and save some time at the end for discussion. We're going to talk in this seminar about rewiring for wealth, and specifically steps 6 and 7. So let's begin with step 6, author new experiences. To create a new money story, I think it's helpful to understand first the dynamics of change. First, the idea of change will create excitement. Remember that people get excited, their brain spikes in the pleasure center with the anticipation of a new story, whether that's spending or of any anticipation of something different. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, trepidation, even anxiety. Then, if you continue rather than return to a comfort zone, expansion into the new experience, and then finally, mastery. Now, there are two additional steps, aspects of experiencing change that I want to just highlight for you as mentor coaches, because they can seem paradoxical to you and especially to a client. One, every step forward means relinquishing a past position. What this means is that somebody must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as physically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story, even ones that don't work as well. This is a process, a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. Remember, whenever there's a fact, a belief, and especially an attachment pattern or a story, it's an anatomical reality in your brain. So it's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior or a hope that by getting the old story just right and doing it better, that it's going to work this time. And secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. Now, this carefully crafted old story, even with some aspects of identity attached, is replaced by something better. So the very best that you've done in the past is now replaced by something better. So it's kind of an injury. It's a narcissistic injury. So my suggestion to you, be sure and do the money mission statement exercise, beginning page 6.2 in the workbook. it can orient and guide in the same way a mission statement does for an organization. So that can be an important aspect of authoring a new experience. Now, let's talk about recognizing and understanding emotional couplings, because this is important to understand going forward. Regardless of how logical you think you are, your first register of a new stimulus is emotional. That's just the way our brains work. Any input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain, then to the hippocampus, which attaches meaning, and this is, of course, the seat of the unconscious. The unconscious is the hippocampus because that's where meaning is attached. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and logically and intellectually to make logical sense. So this means that we make a decision first at the midbrain level and then process it to the forebrain to attach meaning that's going to make it make sense, that we can explain it to ourselves. And neuroeconomics labs have shown that we make purchase decisions up to 8 to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of them. So the emotional activation registers before the cognitive areas of the brain even come into play to assess options. The part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, can activate a buy decision. Just the anticipation of a buy produces dopamine. A don't-buy decision, though, originates in the insula. It's an area involved in anticipating pain. Totally different area of the brain for the buy and the don't-buy decision. So the anticipatory emotions bias as well as drive decision-making. Think about what this means. If you're a credit card company, what do you want to do? You want to decouple the pleasure of buying from the pain of payment, to segment the two by using a credit card. So the pleasure of purchase is right now. The pain of payment, that's next month. And maybe my optimism bias will kick in because I'll have more money. When people do this, when they spend with a credit card, they spend 23% more on average than they do when they buy check or by cash. Decision-making processes in the brain involve shortcuts in analysis, like brands, familiarity, trust. A meaning, for example, that attaches power to money shapes certain choices. Meaning that attaches selfishness to making a considerable sum of money can skew choices in the other directions. So, some questions to accompany important choices. That means that we need to consistently consider to monitor our choices, to question our ideas, and to probe our reasoning. And there are a couple of considerations to not let emotional couplings derail logic. One is, what choices are worth making? And two, how much does each choice cost? With awareness, we can alter our responses and choose our responses. We can write a different story. And I would suggest reviewing on page 6.18, 14 ways to outsmart your brain to spend less. So, money mistakes and financial fallacies. You have an outline, and this was already mentioned, of 25 emotionally-based financial fallacies and their remedies, beginning page 6.6. These compromised money behaviors and financial decisions fall into one of the four categories of ABCs: affect of feeling, behavior, cognitive, or social biases. So there are four kinds of biases, the ABCs: affect or feeling, behavior, cognitive, and social. Now, we've already discussed some of the vignettes for an example, but I want to just highlight a couple in each of these categories just to give you an idea and to discuss how you might hear them in clients. So the key here, one important aspect of these four biases, in addition to abandoning logic and reason, these fallacies transcend age, gender, education, nationality, and race. I want to highlight a couple in each category. Ones I don't think you've seen yet, even from behavioral economists or neuroeconomists. The affect or the emotional biases. One is invincibility bias. The seemingly inextinguishable sense of immortality that we all have when we're young, especially peaking in adolescence. There are still whispers in adulthood. For example, 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. Now, I know that can't be true, especially here in Houston. 75% of people believe they're healthier than average. Or another example, the tech rally investors in the late 1990s. Basically, expertise in one area does not equate with expertise in another. From successful physician to famous artist, people may not translate their accomplishments to money or investment savvy. You know, think about, you go into a physician office or an attorney firm, there's not a single person in that firm that would think that they could take on LeBron James and come out with any kind of reasonable dignity. Every one of them secretly, believe me, I've been there, every one of them secretly believes they can take on Warren Buffett, the superstar in that area, and probably do just as good. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else. An example of behavior biases. Spending justification. Just this once. It's on sale. I deserve it. It'll cheer me up. Life is short. Now, wait, those are all mine. You've got to think of your own. I'm pretty attached to mine. Creating a just cause to spend is the justification bias. Somebody takes money from retirement savings to spend. The justification, well, an immediate need is greater than an abstract future need of retirement. So as a coach, what do you do? How will you repay it? Accountability. Here's a justification travesty. Someone adds up all the money they've saved by buying things on sale, some of which they may have no use for. From that total of savings, the figure is presented as the money that we can now spend, as if it's been generated. Spending twice does not equate with savings once. You've heard somebody say, you know, man, coming out of a store, I just saved $230. Well, that is a total self-deception, because saving $230 means you would take the money and put it in savings. What that creates a blind spot to is, yeah, but you charged $347. Here's a status quo bias, another example of the behavior bias. Resistance to leaving a comfort zone. The status quo bias is another name for inertia. Even smart people who know better engage in negative thinking that results in staying in a comfort zone. Negative thinking lowers expectations, seemingly protecting us. Marketers, for example, know they can set up a continuity program. You've all been exposed to this. A free 3-month trial, called a forced free trial, you give them your credit card number and you get 3 months free. And then if you don't unsubscribe, you begin charging. The inclination, because of the status quo, is to stay with a familiar, not cancel. Just under 80% of all initial free subscribers stay on for the long haul of paid subscription. 62% never read the magazine that's a subscription. People stick with their default choices, even if their choices are costly or compromised. Christopher C., a University of Chicago Business School scientist, did this study with his students. Asked if they would hold on to a stock that lost 50% of its value in the last 3 months, the majority were reluctant to sell and decided they would keep the stock. Now, he asked the same students to imagine that a cat jumps on the computer keyboard and they inadvertently sell these shares. Would they buy back the shares that they were just moments ago reluctant to sell? Almost no one would. So what is this? The inertia effect in both instances is powerful, even though in the last instance, a cat made the investment decision. Now, the power of inertia can be strategically fashioned to produce better outcomes. We can set the program, the status quo, to make good choices, the default pattern. An example, automatic enrollment savings program for retirement. To transfer from your checking account to your retirement account, each month, the first of the month, a good decision only need to be made once. Another example of cognitive biases now. Here's an extrapolation error, which means predicting the future based on the past. Peter Bernstein, who Money Magazine called the smartest living investor, said extrapolation errors are the most common mistake made in investing. A coin is flipped, lands on tails six times in a row. What's your bet as to what the next flip will be? The gambler's fallacy is just this, because no matter how many times in a row tails comes up, it's no more likely to come up tails than heads the next flip. It's still 50-50. The fallacy exists because we remember and we attribute meaning. We see patterns and infer narratives where none exist. We make stories. Our mind needs a story and our brain needs closure. Never mind the closure is not accurate or not a cause and effect, but simply a closure. Our minds and our psyches both abhor ineffectiveness or helplessness. Doing nothing is often the hardest. For example, faced with the reality of losing money in a declining market, the instinct is to do something, to avert or revert the loss, to sell. We have a bias, including cultural, against inactivity, as well as predicting the future on the basis of the past. Now, an example of the last bias, social bias. Affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of the things we like. We overestimate the risk of the things we don't like foreign enemies or an out-of-favor investment. For example, you lose $20 betting a favorite in the Super Bowl. Well, that's unlucky. You lose $200 betting your alma mater will win their most important college game even though they have the worst record in the conference. That's affinity bias. Now, I want to highlight something here I'm not taking time to go over simply because we don't have time, but they're in your outline and in your workbook. The AAA Principles of Change to Author a New Money Story. Awareness, acceptance, and action. These are in your outline. And as you review them, notice that each of these AAA principles to change or author a new money story begins the same way. You're writing your own story, all 12 of them. The first four steps of the roadmap, recognize, observe, assess, and decide, are compressed into the shorthand of the first two A's, awareness and acceptance. The third A, simply mapping change and authoring new experiences in 12 action steps. Now, let's talk about step 7. Program new identity to incorporate and sustain the changes. Remember, we've talked about how this is the most powerful force of the human psyche to revert back to an identity, whatever behavior is changed, unless there's a way of addressing, transforming how and who you see yourself, unless you transform your identity, your operating model, along with the behavior change. And I think this is really, really important for us in mentor coaching, that we do this all along with the client, step by step. So, to review just briefly, operating systems. Behavior patterns and belief systems downloaded especially from parents in the first year of life become automatic. They operate without observation or awareness. Neuroscientists have estimated about 95% of our behaviors and core beliefs are pre-programmed in our unconscious mind and operate on autopilot. So that means, as we've talked before, just to reiterate here, we can create two stories simultaneously. The surface story that we run our lives with conscious intentions and aspirations. An example, I want to make significant money and accumulate wealth. Now, at the same time, there's a shadow story the belief systems, the cumulative awareness and models and attachment and behavior patterns that are in our operating system that can ghostwrite behavior sometimes in the opposite direction than a conscious intention. So here's how that shadow story can sound. Juxtaposed with the surface story, I want to make significant money and accumulate wealth. Well, you know, I can't really get what I want, or the system keeps me from doing what I need. I don't think I have what it takes, or, you know, I see all this change and all this uncertainty and time away from my family. I think I'm just as happy where I am. Many compromises occur when two or more money stories are written simultaneously. Here's a simple example. I want to generate more income, but the shadow story says, I don't think this person could pay my full coaching fee. Remember not to project this aspect of your story onto a client. A recent study found something really important in my view. The more clearly and fully that you can picture your future self, the more money you save for the future. Think about it. The more you identify with your future self, the more your financial decisions have long-term benefits. So let's talk now in this misstep of programming identity about change and transition. The change is the event, the situation. You change your behavior, move to a new city, have a baby, take a new job. When we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the SMART goals. The transition is the process. It's the internal story of change, a shift in orientation, and even self-definition. Transition is attention to the seasonal cycles as well as the daily weather. So as you create change and embrace transition, you let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into your new story. This is the P of the roadmap. Program new identity. And this is to sustain and enhance the changes that you make. So there are four components of transition that I want to just review with you. This is for, again, for your reference, for you to have an operating model of what you're hearing and how you're guiding a client. One, every transition begins with an ending. Willingly or unwillingly, an ending. It involves letting go of familiar, even habitual, routines in order to establish new patterns. Never underestimate the need and the power and the difficulty of letting go. To do new things a new way, you have to end the way you do them now. To become something new, you have to give up some of the old self. To transition to a new possibility, you have to let go of something familiar. Two, people in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. We've talked about how the mind and brain considerations in change and how to facilitate that change are really, really important. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. We can expect this as part of a transition. Think about your transitions. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. And you can help reframe this return to the familiar as a way of measuring progress, as an opportunity to validate a commitment to move forward. Three, the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity, or I should say especially aspects of your identity. The impact and meaning of the transition may bear little resemblance, though, to the apparent significance of the change that precipitated. Now, this can be confusing at first. Someone can become discombobulated by a seemingly minor illness because it shatters an illusion of vulnerability. Or another person can take the loss of a parent in stride but be devastated by the loss of their dog. Some people are like one tragedy behind. Four, never underestimate the change back pressure from the system. Your family, your company, it's their self-statement of reaction to change, an attempt to restore normal order and not do the work of change. Their brains work the same way yours does, to push back against change, to want to hold on to the status quo and avoid the pain, the uncertainty of changing. So they're giving you the feedback. They're mirroring the same thing because this is the collective response that they have as well. A group or a system has a status quo bias and inertia, just like an individual does. Jung said, the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. So let's look now at the neuroscience of decision and conflict. You see a car swerving into your lane headed directly for you. In a matter of a couple of seconds, your life could be over. As soon as you perceive the danger, you reflexively hit the brake pedal and horn, sharply turn the steering wheel. In a matter of a second or less, your physiology has changed. You're exhausted, short of breath, heart racing. Emotional chemicals triggered by an automatic alarm reaction instantly change your state to survival. Now, each thought and feeling has a chemical consequence. The chemicals of emotion alter mind and body. Personal experience determines what software program, in other words, what state of mind, to use to produce the data and how to respond. Threat or danger triggers emotional chemicals that hijack the logical, rational brain. Now, at times, this natural survival response is adaptive, but at other times, excitement, good or bad, can cause mistaken perception or bad judgment and reaction. A hot stock tip, a business deal gone sour, a family tragedy. Each can create an alarm response and an emotional state of mind that's geared for survival rather than logic. Neuroscientists use functional magnetic resonance imaging, I've referred to fMRIs in our seminar series, to study the responses and functioning of the brain to various emotional stimuli. These studies and their findings can help us know how we make decisions that can be in our long-term best interest. At times, logic can take a back seat in financial decision-making. For example, shopping can change the way you feel. It can be state-changing. When people feel insecure emotionally or economically, they can elevate their state. They can reassure themselves or distract themselves by shopping. Remember, the anticipation of purchase triggers the pleasure chemical, which is entirely state-changing. For the most expensive shops on Madison Avenue, one of their best days in history was the day Lehman Brothers failed. When the going gets tough. Another, brain scans show that the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, lights up when people simply consider a purchase. The insula, the brain structure activated by pain, lights up when somebody thinks about cost. So this is why these two can be segmented by a credit card. So let's look now at choice enhancement. These are some considerations that apply to emotions and choices and might be helpful to us in mentor coaching as we're listening to these stories from clients. One, increased tension can produce emotional regression. In other words, a state change to an earlier time, an earlier state of mind. With increased tension and conflict, the stress response reaction can move someone to an emotional pattern characteristic of a much earlier age. In other words, a state change that state originated at an earlier time. Secondly, increased emotion also narrows perspective. A client, an executive woman, said, I'm so preoccupied with my portfolio losing value, it's hard to focus on my work. When emotion prevails, focus becomes narrower and more restricted to the most recent event, the recency bias. Paradoxically, for a client like this, attempting to use reason and logic when somebody's in a highly emotional state deepens the automatic alarm pattern. If they're escalated, they're going to further escalate. They're going to dig in their toes and spiral toward more extreme responses and hurl themselves away from logic. The stress response hormones of epinephrine and cortisol also block information processing. So remember this, when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings and state of mind to get centered and grounded. Remember we talked initially, state always comes first, then strategy and story. And here's a quote from a Buddhist teaching. Return to the earth now if your mind is troubled and your heart is uncertain, for it is by returning to the beginning that we can clearly see the path. A very literal and metaphorical way to say get grounded and centered. Now, let's talk a little bit about commitment devices. As an accountability partner, professional coaches may consider commitment devices. There have been studies on how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behaviors they know are in their best interest. Think about it. We help our kids do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device to counter impulsive purchase. Other ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment to a better response. People find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. A study at Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing want products, non-essentials, and should products, essentials. They would devise ways to put off either purchasing or having delivered the want products to ensure that they would do what they needed to do first. Or money stories can incorporate goofy to sublime commitment devices. I heard from a woman after I released my book, The Secret Language of Money, how she froze a credit card in a big block of ice to counter her impulsive purchases. It worked, I guess. Automatic retirement deposits to make a commitment a one-time decision is another example. So consider how to prioritize your shoulds and reward doing them with your wants. This reframes wants as part of a performance ethic. It removes guilt and links to performance what you know you're going to do anyhow. And planning is a different scenario than impulsivity. So I want to add this before we stop. The most frequent mistakes made in writing a new money story. One, not knowing that you don't know. Now, how can people know they don't know something? We believe we know, which can blind us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. So we have to have a beginner's mind. To know to ask is half the answer. Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this can be a correct strategy, but it can also stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be more effective. So we may have to ask, and then what, or what else? Now, this is not to be confused with continuing to figure it out instead of doing it, as in ready, aim. I want to introduce number three with a brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, though, planned their strategy, their action plan, and then they decided they would jump off. How many were left? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. The broad themes, the big patterns, include putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Many of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We have little sense of urgency, which can contribute to a lack of focus. Now, we know theoretically that time is limited, but when the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in the final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. Well, not the Texans, but that's another story. This imminent deadline, a limited finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases efforts. In our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but don't really internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. 4. Inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths and limitations, your biological cycles, when you perform best. Know how to enter and exit various states of mind and which state works best for a particular task. For example, writing and editing, two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at different times and not combined. 5. Ambiguity. Sometimes for a client, what looks like resistance can simply be a lack of clarity. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Save more money is not a strategy. When you want to affect change, help script specific behaviors. 6. Too many choices. Some studies showed how an HR department or individual investment advisor can provide too many choices, and the extra options can backfire, leading to decision paralysis. For every 10 options offered, the employee's rate of participation goes down by 2%. At some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, and someone retreats to the default mode of simply not making a choice. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing. I remember going to the academic center in college and taking two or three books and then sitting down and thinking about, oh, my God, all this I have to do on all these three subjects, so I'd promptly take a nap. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's willingness to stay the course. Guess who said this? It's not that I'm so smart. It's that I stay with problems longer. That was Albert Einstein. Malcolm Gladwell, in his next to last book, Outliers, talks about how remarkable success in an area is not the result of genius, exceptional talent, or remarkable luck. It's hard work. Research shows again and again that excellence at performing complex tasks requires a minimum of 10,000 hours for true expertise. This is as true for basketball players as it is for writers, composers, chess players, master criminals. 10,000 hours of practice to achieve mastery associated with being a world-class expert. 8, not following success trails. Decide how you want to proceed and expand. Then pick success trails to follow. Create a support team. Construct an advisory board, a networking group. Engage a mentor. Join a mastermind group. 9, believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. There does not have to be a split between spirituality and money. There is nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? Abundance, wealth, spirituality are synonyms. The antonyms, suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. And remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches. Rich and spiritual are synonyms. When somebody says, I'm not in it for the money, I believe that person because I know the experience, unless it's a rationalization for not making much money. When you're truly immersed, passionate, and delivering immense value, that is synonymous with abundant income. It's the result when there's alignment. Having a fantastic experience of bringing value to people and making fantastic money are seamlessly interwoven in a spiritual path. You will improve your health by creating less stress, as stress causes the body to be less healthy. You will create an attitude and an experience of abundance, which will also enhance wellness. Now, there's a detailed outline in your workbook about visualization and affirmation. Now, just a couple of highlights here. When you program your system with a visualized goal of successfully attaining what you want, you create structural tension in your brain, cognitive dissonance. It's the difference between where you are and where you visualize and affirm. Your brain then strives to end this tension by actualizing the goal. Affirmations also provide the story to support your vision. So a vision is a way of rewiring your brain. Affirmations are rewiring your software to support your vision. So structural tension, this dissonance in your brain, will give you creative ideas, help you see things you haven't seen before, a perceptual shift, and help with motivation to take action. Remember, the universe rewards action. For example, if you see yourself in a successful business, you create the specific imagery to live that experience. You then incorporate it as part of your identity rather than it just being a nice fantasy or it belonging to somebody else. When you program your unconscious, you actually create a future memory to live into. Your brain can't tell who conjured it. You are reality through your optic nerve. The more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. The key elements are, one, repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision must be renewed and repeated regularly. In other words, every morning and every night. And secondly, be very specific about the experience of achieving the goal. Consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be ultimately metabolized as part of your sense of self. Otherwise, this will fade. You'll lose your vision. This may be why, for example, 95% of people who diet and lose significant weight gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image. Affirmations make a visualization a complete story. To summarize one more time, affirmations reprogram your mind. Visualizations rewire your brain. Our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. Here's a story to illustrate this. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During this time that he was in prison, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had 299s. All his other scores were in triple digits. To preserve his sanity, he decided to visualize playing golf. He did this all day long, 24 hours a day. He would 7 days a week, rather. And he would get up and then began to visualize getting dressed, driving to his favorite golf club, and taking warm-up shots, smelling the flowers, being the sight, seeing the sky, would then make the entire stroke as he visualized his body, walk up to the ball, and did this for 7 to 8 hours a day, every day for 7 years. After he was released from his captivity, playing golf in his mind 7 days a week for 7 years, his first outing, he shot a 74. The power of a vision of mind over matters. So, let's review 4 essentials in engineering effectiveness for a new money story. 1, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map, because a map can help you know where you are now, where you're going, measure progress along the way, and also tell what's detour and what's distraction. 2, make progress specifically measurable, step by step. 3, make progress visible, and celebrate each small victory. You know, think about it this way. If you decide you're going to lose 20 pounds and you're going to lose a pound a week, and you're at week 19 and you've lost 19 pounds and your goal is to lose 20 pounds, you've had 19 weeks of failure by definition because you haven't lost 20 pounds. Now, if you frame it a different way, if you decide you're going to get to a certain weight and you're going to lose 1 pound a week, you've had 19 weeks of successes. Guess which feels better and guess which is going to be more sustained? 4, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global. Shrink the change, make it specific. And think about it this way. All you ever have to do in life is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to an immediate step of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. And remember this caveat. You may not always know exactly what the next right thing is or still be figuring out, but you can almost always know what it isn't. So, in a summary, because I want to allow some time to discuss, here's a brief overview of the 7 steps. We've taken a journey now to illuminate and change your money story. We reviewed these 7 steps. Recognize authorship. Own your story. Assess the plot and storylines. Decide what to change. Map changes. Author new experiences. And program new identity. This is in alignment, in concert with how the mind and brain works. And when this is in concert with your needs and your ideals, with a specific goal and strategies in mind, there'll be no stopping you. In these 7 steps, we've articulated some of the secret language of money, how some money issues are really about money, but how a bunch of other things hitchhike on money, and how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These 7 steps, deconstruct how you write your money story and live it. They're also building blocks to revise a money story or write a new one. And here's my final challenge to each of you. This is from the final page of the curriculum for New Life Story Wellness. What if right now is a turning point for you? The time your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. The time you awakened your deep passion and acted on it. The time you did what you were always meant to do. Or this moment of truth may be a brief awakening, silenced by the sensible obstacles you're familiar with constructing. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content telling stories about your favorite sports team or what great cookies you used to bake. It will all depend on how brave you are. And to that, I want to add the words of my favorite grandmother. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. What would be helpful to talk about? Any clarifications or questions? Or additions?
Thanks, Dave. I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Deb. I appreciate that. Let me ask again, after you've reflected on all 4 seminars, what's the most important thing, what is your this? Even though some of you have heard this before, what is the most important thing you're taking away right now?
This is Marlon Day.
Yes.
One of the things that throughout every week I think about, it just comes back to almost rewiring your brain and rewriting your own blueprint and get rid of everything that we have inherited from our parents, from the society that we live in, and just write our own blueprint from scratch anyway.
And you can delete almost. It is rewiring. It is revising the software. Go ahead. You were about to speak.
Oh, no, you were saying, but I couldn't hear you. There was a chuckling on the other line.
I said you can delete almost. It is a rewiring of your brain. It is a revision of your software. This is a change that impacts something, as we just talked, as core, as fundamental, as bedrock, as your identity. And this is a way of looking at being aware of that 95% of your operating system that previously was unconscious and you only saw derivatives in various behaviors. This is a way of looking at the whole structure of how you're operating. So it's going to be disconcerting at times. It's going to be confusing at times because trying something new always begins with trepidation, with anxiety, with uncertainty. None of us has ever begun anything new or different that has any importance whatsoever that didn't begin with anxiety and uncertainty. Remember that for every client at every step of change. And that can help you resonate with their experience and empathically understand that. Then go to someplace new together.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Other comments about what you're taking away that that has been most important to you?
Hello, this is Paula from Brazil.
Would you say that again? There's such an echo, it's hard to hear you. Say it again, please.
Paula from Brazil.
Oh, hi. How are you? Great. Go ahead, please, again.
One thing that has most impressed me is the master state of mind, and I'm having great experiences in, like, going back home, going back to my center, going back to my heart, connecting my mind with my heart, and in this way, I have been able to master some states of mind. It's practice. I mean, sometimes it's not instantaneously, but the more I practice, the more close I get to it. And it helps me make good decisions.
I agree with you that is the most important thing that we do in mentor coaching, is to help someone master states of mind and develop that self-regulation. There's another seminar series that I'm going to do in September about mind and brain coaching mastery that will look more closely at the states of mind and the mind and brain issues in coaching. It's about the art and neuroscience of change, beginning September the 5th. You'll get a notice from that, from CTA. So thank you, Paula, for sharing that. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I totally agree with you. We just got a minute or two. Who else?
Dave, could you remind us on the other most powerful way to create lasting change other than mastering the mind and emotion?
I'm sorry. There was a sound. Other than what?
Well, mastering your emotions and, you know, for creating changes. But what was the other one?
I think, and you'll recall the four-column chart, the idea of state comes first because state is what determines the meaning we attach, and the meaning we attach determines our behavior. So to recognize anything, any emotional cue or trigger that would create a shift of a state to anything that's even slightly altered, of getting upset or react to any kind of reactive state to any emotional cue or trigger. The important thing is to recognize that cue or that trigger and any of the state and all the content of that state, any self-talk or all the things that you'd say to yourself that are negative, all of that is to recognize as quickly as possible in order to get grounded and centered, then to move to an ideal response and to have all of that pre-established. So basically, I know we have to stop, but draw three vertical lines on a piece of paper. First column, emotional cues or trigger. Second column is usual response. That's the old story. That's the altered state. And all the content of that altered state is what we usually get stuck in. So the idea is not to feel your feelings from that state, but to recognize that as quickly as possible by getting grounded and centered, third column, and then move to an ideal response, so that ultimately, after you do this enough, and the old cue or trigger, instead of leading to the stuckness in that old state in the second column, when you move through getting grounded and centered to an ideal response, this will be the neural conditioning to rewire your brain. So the awareness of this process, I think, is really huge. So, and I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk about it, but and that's a real short shrift. Deb, does that make sense?
Yeah, I wanted you to remind me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you all very much. If there are questions, don't hesitate to send me an email. Thank you all very much for participation and feedback. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it totally.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.